all have had a good lunch. Welcome back to the afternoon portions of the conference. Our next speaker has a unique background, certainly compared to the rest of us here. He experienced the years of World War II and its ending firsthand in Japan. After graduating from high school there, he came to the United States to attend college on a GRU scholarship, which is named after the last American ambassador to Japan before the outbreak of the Pacific War. Originally interested in British history, later at graduate school he switched to studying U.S. East Asian relations, especially in the crucial decades leading to the outbreak of the war. Indeed, World War II features prominently in many of his works, and his works have become classics that not only reshape the field of East Asian Pacific history, but also transform the study of international history as a whole. As a recognition of his accomplishment, he was elected and became the first non-US born president of the American Historical Association in 1988. After teaching for many years at University of Chicago and Harvard University, he has retired and is now the Charles Warren Research Professor of American History at Harvard. However, he remains a prolific scholar and frequent participant at international conferences, and I'm glad to add also a frequent visitor to theaters and music festivals on different continents. Almost 30 years ago, when I was a young college sophomore in China, I read a short article of his in a journal in a library, and I was transfixed. Since that moment, he has been a great source of inspiration, and fortunately for me, a mentor in graduate school and beyond. So it is my tremendous personal honor to present to you the keynote speaker, Professor Akira Irie.
Thank you very much, Dajin. Can you hear me? I have some trouble. I think this is inevitable with somebody my age, that my hearing is deteriorating rather rapidly. And besides, I made the fatal mistake of not bringing an extra hearing aid battery. I just looked all over my bag and don't find it. And so I do have one battery here, my right hand hearing aid. But I guess I'll have to sort of turn my face this way when you have a question so I can hear you with my right hand. I think that's my identification. I mean, Dutch was so very kind talking about my career and things like that. But my primary self-image, myself, is somebody who is about to be 81 years old, who is deteriorating many ways in my hearing and with other kind of things. But nevertheless, somebody who tries to keep up, and it's not as easy as it used to be to keep up with the world of scholarship because it progresses all the time. But I try, and what I would like to do, in accordance to Darjeeling's request, is to talk a bit about my personal experiences, particularly 70 years ago, August 1945, and then what I have made of it, I guess, basically, and what I've been trying to do with that kind of field of study of war and peace, international relations, and that kind of thing. I thought I should bring the diary I kept. 1945, of course, Japan surrenders on the 15th of August, 1945. On the 19th of August, I start keeping a diary. And I have been keeping a diary ever since, because in those days my diary writings were rather detailed and pretty factual in many ways. I mean, most of the fact in those days consisted of food, how much food we had, or how little food we had, basically, because almost every day I talk about going to look for some food to eat, visiting some farmers outside of Tokyo, begging for food. Basically, you had to beg for food because neither Japanese government nor the occupation authorities initially were able to provide us with much rice, particularly rice was very important. So my grandmother, because my mother was rather sickly and weak, my grandmother and I would go take a train, a very crowded train, going out to nearby prefectures in search of rice, basically. You just go to these farmers' houses, go in there, begging for food, would you have some rice to? My grandmother would say, this child is starving, would you please spare some boiled rice so we could eat it? Well, most people said, no, I'm sorry. You've got to do better than just begging. You've got to give some watches or clothes or precious jewelry or something in exchange for. They're very, very mean people. I became very, very anti-Japanese farmers. Onwards. But in many ways, I mean, my memories of those days are pretty miserable. But except that with the end of war, there was a sense of real transformation of the country, myself. Because up until that time, I was born in 1934, and this is a diversion, but my wife and I now live in a retirement community not too far from here, in a place called Gwinnett, Pennsylvania, which is outside of Philadelphia, where the average age is 84 of the residents, and I'm about to be 81, so I'm getting there, about 84. And when you associate yourselves with people who are about that age in their 80s, of course, that means most of us were born in 1930s, and 1930s for my generation, would mean the depression in the United States, war in Japan, war in China, colonialism in Korea, then the coming war in the Pacific and in Asia and so on. I mean, for us and for most Chinese, I think the war began in 1931 with the Japanese invasion of Manchuria. It does not end until 1945. That's why it's known as a 15-year war. So when I was born in 1934, Japan was already in the process of occupying China, and 3 years later, in 1937, Japan would start its war of aggression against China, the Nanjing atrocities, other things happened, about most of which I was totally ignorant at the time, but in retrospect, of course, I read about these things. Then 1941, war comes with Pearl Harbor, and what happened to us school children in Tokyo was that in 1944, most of us were evacuated to the country. I mean, I guess the authorities decided that we would be the next generation of Japanese soldiers, and Japan is going to continue the war, or there will be more military action in the future. We would have to be preserved, so we were sent to the country, detached from our parents. And I think in 1944, I was just 10 years old. I myself, at the school, the children were sent away from our school, from our living areas in Tokyo to the countryside, in our case, Nagano Prefecture. And spent the final 10 months or so, October 1944 almost to the end of the war, in August 1945. And I think without that, those were the most miserable months of my life. I think I have had rather miserable childhood experiences, but to be sent away from my parents, to be separated from my parents when you're only 10 years old, put together in this dormitory type situation, a very tiny room with 10 other kids, and not being fed very much, and to be most seriously, not really being given any kind of education. I mean, we are there together in this dormitory, and what we are supposed to do is to work on the farm and help the farmers. No education there whatsoever. So for 44 to 45, I was up in the fourth grade, fifth grade, no education whatsoever. And then all of a sudden, war comes to an end. So that was a real sense of relief, I think, that this kind of thing was going to come to an end and things might go back to a semblance of normality. Which it did in time. I think by 1947 or so, the occupation administration was in place, and as you know, there was a new education reform under the leadership of the U.S. occupation, and everything changed. Education was going to be more liberal education kind of schooling, and no emphasis on this nationalistic excesses. I mean, I think this is one of the things that occupation authorities mentioned, that they would censor textbooks, censor teachers even, and we wanted to make sure that we would learn about the past, about geography, everything that would give us the sense that Japan is not the exception country. Japan was not historically ordained to rule the world, or Japan was not geographically unique, and that kind of thing. Became more, Japan just became one of those countries, and that was a very great thing for us, the sense of liberation, that Japan was just one of many countries. So that was wonderful. In many ways, I felt a sense of liberation that I could start from scratch to learn things. And then incredibly, very luckily, in 1953, I came to the United States. Dajin kindly mentioned the fact that I was a recipient of a scholarship granted by the so-called Joseph C. Grew Foundation. Joseph C. Grew was U.S. ambassador to Japan between 1931 and 1941, I think, until Pearl Harbor, and he comes back to the United States and serves as Undersecretary of State in the State Department. I think that really says something about Ambassador Grew and the United States, the sense of generosity, that he was U.S. ambassador, served in Japan for 10 years, and what did he do? Right after the war, he decided to donate the money that he had gotten from the sale of his book. He writes a memoir called 10 Years in Japan, which he published during the war in the United States. Becomes one of the bestsellers, I think, and after the war, it is translated into Japanese, and it's read very, very widely. So royalty income from that, from the sale of his book, both in original and translation, must have been quite substantial. He donates all of that, to establish a foundation so that he would enable Japanese high school students, graduates, to come to the United States. Because he said, the reconciliation between two countries, U.S. and Japan, will now lie in the hands of young people. The old people are hopeless, but the younger people could be looked for. I mean, he was absolutely right. The old people are hopeless, but young people, our generation, I think, were pretty open-minded, I think. And so my parents encouraged me to apply for that, and incredibly, I was very lucky. I was one of the first four students to be chosen with a Grew Foundation scholarship, and then the foundation sent me to Haverford College. Very few Japanese or even Americans would have heard of Haverford College, a very tiny Quaker school with 400 students outside of Philadelphia. But there was an American committee with the Grew Foundation. The American committee somehow decided that these Japanese high school graduates should be sent to small liberal arts colleges rather than to big state universities or big graduate-oriented places like Harvard, Yale. But so they picked these small places. Like I was sent to Haverford. Another of the four first ones was sent to Lafayette College, Eastern Pennsylvania. There were two girls. One girl was sent to Knox College in Illinois. The other one is called Denison College, Ohio. I still remember these places because this was such an eye-opening experience for us to be reading catalogs of these colleges, find out what American colleges were like, what we would be studying, because everything was so very different. I must say that I was very lucky that the war came to an end when it did in 1945, and that I was one of the first students to be sent to the United States in 1953. I think it says two things. One is that people of my generation in Japan, in any event, have been pretty lucky. I exchanged my email messages with some classmates, from high school classmates of mine, who still live in Tokyo, and as I said, most of my classmates would have been born in 1934, 33, 35. Now it's around age 80, right? And for our generation, I think there's a pretty consistent image of the 1930s and the war years and so on. That is, we are so fortunate that we are not old enough to be sent to the military front as soldiers. We're too young to be sent, even though we are not lucky enough to avoid this kind of being displacement in the countryside. But nevertheless, we're not sent to war. And by the time we were teenagers, the war was over, and therefore we were able to study in peace. We didn't have to worry about a bombing raid or anything of that kind. That Japan was going to be a peaceful country, and there was disarmament, peace orientation, a peace constitution. That's why if you talk to people, my generation, they're just so very grateful for the post-war U.S. Reforms. They're very grateful for the fact that Japan has remained in peace, has had a peace constitution. It doesn't matter really if that was a constitution that was drafted by GHQ in Tokyo, general headquarters in MacArthur. The fact remains that we have been a very fortunate generation. We were spared military service and we grew up in peace after 1934. And I was particularly lucky, as I said, because I was given the opportunity to come to the United States to study. And then whatever I have done, trying to do in my life, has followed from that, I think, from college to graduate school. And of course, in this country, it's such a generous country. You know, I think you may have some critical things to say about the United States, but bottom line is, this is a very generous country. It's a very open-minded, diverse community today. I was a guest of the United States basically for 64 years. Now I'm a U.S. citizen, but nobody asked me if I was a U.S. citizen or not. I mean, when I applied for a job in the United States, there are more jobs available, and so you apply for a job and you compete with other authentic American citizens, and quite often I'd be given a job. I mean, they never, over 6 years or so when I applied for a job, they never asked me if I was a U.S. citizen or if I was a foreigner, those kinds of things. So I think this country remained very, very open-minded, even during the McCarthy era. When I came to the United States, that was 1953, the height toward the waning stage of McCarthyism. But that did not affect the atmosphere, I don't think, a higher education. None of our students, colleagues, or faculty, I think, were afraid of Marxism. We studied Marxism in college, we studied the Soviet Union, and nobody thought we are being subversive or anything. I think studying was one thing, and scholarship and so on. And so that's another thing. Intellectual openness, academic freedom, those things are there, even during the height of Marxism. And there were many foreign students, I think in particular from Germany and Japan, right after the war. I think the State Department or others in the U.S. education community must have decided that the best way to bring about reconciliation with the former enemy countries was to bring students from there. And I think, I'm very, very grateful for that. I wanted to say something about China as well, because we have been talking about China today. I did not have an opportunity to go to China until much later after the war. I think the first time I went to China may have been 2007, something like that. But my father was a China, in the sense of China specialist, in the sense that he worked for a news service called the Domei Press. The Domei Press was one of the news service organizations that would send collect news and send news items to various newspapers, like the AP and UPI in the United States. And My father served in China for many, many years, and he kept a diary, and I just brought one, just to give you some idea of what it looks like. This was 1945, so really the last year of the war. It starts on April 15th and ends on June 18th, 1945, the last days of his he had stayed in China. It's written in Japanese, and his Japanese handwriting is so atrocious that I can't read all of it, but I've tried to. It's very interesting. It's a diary in China that he kept, talks about what he did every day, what he ate. That's one thing he and I had in common, very interested in food. But whereas his diary, almost every day, ends with recording what he ate that day and what wine, what whiskey. He was a whiskey drinker. That's what made me turn against whiskey drinking, because I saw him too often being drunk, and I didn't want to be like that myself. But in any event, he was a real friend of China, because he used to spend his childhood in China, because his father was a lawyer in Shanghai, and so he would spend summers and things like that. So he spoke Chinese quite well. He was able to read Chinese characters and Chinese classics, and I still remember my father reading Chinese aloud, so that to keep up with Chinese pronunciation, he was able to do that. So he was very pro-Chinese, but nevertheless, he was in the war, and his diary indicates 1945, summer. He was being summoned by the Japanese military army in China, because the Japanese military must have been getting pretty desperate to draft people like my father, who was at the time 41 years old. And he said when he reported, there were others his age, people around age 40, who were living in China, were being summoned by Japanese military authorities, I presumably to join the military in China. But then, fortunately for him, when he went in there and when he looked at, he said, the authorities decided he was not fit to serve in the armed service, so he was freed. He was free that moment. But he writes about these things. And I have many volumes of his diary, and then I remember when the war came to an end in 1945, he told me I should start keeping a diary to record what I thought about what was going on. And so as I said, I started keeping a diary on the 19th of August, and I still do today, even though nowadays what I write down is very, very simple, and just recording just a few lines a day. But thanks to my diary, I think I can reconstruct some of the things that I was doing in 1945, I was feeling 1945, and then equally interestingly, what I thought I felt when I came to the United States in 1953 and so on. So, but that's one thing I thought I should do, just to urge you to keep a diary. If you don't keep a diary anymore, it's going to be very, very helpful when you talk about, when you think about writing a memoir, or even if you don't think about writing a memoir, when somebody asks you when you're 80 years old to come and talk about yourself. it's good to have something, some basis, foundation, structural foundation for what you're going to say, because memory is very unreliable, right? I mean, what I think, what I remember of the past, 1945, even 1975 or 2010, can be rather self-centered. I mean, you might try to remember how things were from your standpoint, and could be distorted, could be somewhat manipulated, and so on. But in any event, in my own case, I started writing a diary on the 19th of August. And I do talk about Americans coming in to occupy Tokyo streets. The attitude of myself, a 10-year-old boy at the time, becoming 11, was that Now the country was under US occupation. Americans were basically decent people, that is such. According to my diary, anyway, they would come into a neighborhood and so on, and they all go into a store and make some purchases and pay for these purchases. And there's no violence, there's no crime as such in our neighborhood anyway. And so we got a very favorable, I think, impression of US GIs. Of course, the US occupation continues beyond the peace treaty, not the occupation, US military presence after the peace treaty in Japan 1952. It goes into effect 1953, that was when I came to the United States. I mention these things in part because I think your generational identity may be rather important in building your personality, your view of yourself, that kind of thing. So people my generation in Japan, some friends I still correspond with, I think share my view that we were very fortunate, we were a lucky generation for reasons that I've sketched. And many of them remain quite pro-peace constitution, anti-militarism, and even anti-nationalistic. I think many of them are more aware of the world than some of the younger generation, rather than the Prime Minister. Yeah, I think Mike Majik's right and other people are right. He's rather dismally ignorant of what goes on in the world, I think, but China, Korea. He's dismally ignorant of history too, because I was reading his speech in Washington at a joint meeting, Congress. In the second paragraph, he said more than 100 years ago, vast colonies possessed mainly by the Western powers stretched out across the world with their overwhelming supremacy in technology, waves of colonial rule stretched toward Asia in the 19th century, and so on. There's no mention of Japanese colonization, Taiwan, Korea. By the time the West got to Asia, I mean, Japan had already colonized Okinawa first and Taiwan, and Korea was about to fall to Japanese domination and so on. And this is the Prime Minister of Japan, year 2015, totally exhibiting his rather dismal ignorance of recent history. And if this is his view of Japan today, one wonders what his view of other countries today would be. It's totally wrong. The Japan-Russia war gave encouragement to many people under colonial rule from Asia to Africa. That's absolute nonsense. I mean, the Japan-Russia war was fought for Japan's own self-interest. Japanese did not liberate the Koreans. In fact, instead of liberating Koreans from Russian rule, post-Russian rule, Japan went in there to colonize Korea. And then I thought, what is interesting? I mean, he just blames other people. Talking about 1930s, talking about the Great Depression, which set in, and Western countries launched economic blocks by involving colonial economies, and so it's, again, it's as if Japan became a victim. Japan had to do what it did because the Western powers were establishing their economic blocks. And in such circumstances, Japan's sense of isolation deepened, and it attempted to overcome its diplomatic and economic deadlock, which it created by itself, through the use of force, that kind of thing. I mean, this is simply misreading history to fit Japanese purposes, and that's absolutely wrong. Since in the 1932, Japan took the wrong course. I mean, he does say Japan took a wrong course in international affairs by withdrawing from the League of Nations, and he says advanced along the road to war. I mean, such a harmless way of saying that Japan began the war. Actually, advanced along the road to war. I mean, what does it mean, Japan?
advanced along the West War. Japan invaded Manchuria, invaded China, attacked Pearl Harbor. There's not one mention of Pearl Harbor here. That is absolutely wrong, right? There's a museum, semi-public museum outside of Tokyo in Sakura called the Japan Museum of History and Anthropology or something, which is pretty good. I mean, I think this is said to be the first time that the officially subsidized but privately run, what mostly privately run, museum of recent history was founded in Sakura. It's not just recent history, it goes back to Edo and earlier, but they decided to add a 20th century segment to that. And for some reason, they wanted me to be on the advisory committee. So I joined that, and there was a meeting about 5 years ago, something like that. And I noticed that there was nothing about 20th century. And so one of the things that I, along with other members of the committee, said was that, well, if you're going to have a museum of history and anthropology, you do have to have a wing, a special area of the museum set aside for an exhibition of 20th century Japanese history. And they did that. But then when they did that, wanted me to show it with us, to show it. Again, this kind of prime minister's type language is used. Overall trends in the world, Japan took the wrong course and advanced along the road to war. I said, well, why is there nothing but Pearl Harbor? I mean, after all, it was Pearl Harbor that brought the United States into war. If Japan had not attacked Pearl Harbor, there would have been no war, right, between US and Japan. They said they had not been aware of it, that somehow they had to add Pearl Harbor. I said, well, that's a fact. So there are unpleasant facts probably to remember, and for nationalists who think that all the past wars and things were inevitable or justifiable, I think to mention something like Pearl Harbor might be quite painful, but you have to do it. There's absolutely no way. This may not be just limited to Japanese. I served in the 1990s in a committee called the National Committee on History Education. I don't know if you remember. It was basically promoted by the National Institute of Education or something like that. It's a Washington organization that promotes the history of education. Even though this headquarters of this particular organization may have been at UCLA, but I served on the committee, and what we were asked to do, NEH was behind this, was to go over school textbooks, U.S. history textbooks. And I think we made a few recommendations. For example, I mean, this one of these, quite famous, I think, that many of American members of this committee felt that there was not enough on slavery. That is, it was a pretty good feel-good kind of view of the American past. So they thought, the committee thought that there ought to be more honest confrontation with the fact of slavery. Among other things, the atomic bombing. The initial textbooks, we noticed that there was no mention anywhere about the fact that the atomic bombs were first dropped in Japan, and we made a mention of it. And the U.S. Senate, and then when this was written about in the press, then the U.S. Senate became very angry that this committee should say something very critical of U.S. wartime decisions. And I think the Senate passed a resolution by a vote of 100-0 or something, censuring this report, saying this report should be castigated because it mentioned atomic bombings. So I mention this case to say that it's not just the Japanese who are very self-defensive, very nationalistic when it comes to somebody else talking about their behavior. And so it's not surprising, I think, as you heard this morning, among Chinese and Koreans and Japanese and so on, when they read each other's textbooks, they become very upset or distressed. The only solution Dachin and Mike Mutsuki, others have been saying, is really to bring about historians from the oldest countries and see if they might not be able to study the past together. Fortunately, I think Americans and Japanese have been doing that to some extent. I remember the AHA, the American Historical Association, had its annual session in December, I think, on the 25th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. So this would be 1941 plus 25 and 1966. Was it session of the AHA was held in New York. And already at that time, there was a particular panel on the coming of the war in the Pacific on Pearl Harbor, and there were some Japanese historians invited to that, and American historians came together. There was a very scholarly discussion. And in most seriously, 1966, this is 25 years of 1969, 28 years after Pearl Harbor, there was a serious scholarly conference. American historians and Japanese historians came together in Hakone. People like Michael Lickius Mentor, Waldo Heinrichs was there, and Dorothy Borg was there, and Ernest May was to have been there. Ernest May already by then was a prominent historian, and he would have been a very good asset to the conference, except that he happened to be dean of college at Harvard, and his dean's office was being occupied by students. Timing was very bad, 1969, so he was not able to get out of his building, get out of his office to join us. So I guess that gave us another view of American freedom of expression, I guess. But, nevertheless, Dorothy Brough came, and Jim Wally, there's other people came, and so we had this wonderful conference and produced a book called Pearl Harbor in History. It's still quite good today. So I always feel that no matter what happens at the policy level, I mean, we may not be able to change what Abe thinks, what Abe does, but at least for us, for scholars who are trying to promote mutual understanding, better international relations, and so on, the most we can do, or the least we can do, is to have these kinds of symposia, joint projects, conferences, so that historians from various countries come together, not as nationalistic defenders of what their countries do, but basically on the basis of the evidence, archival research, free, frank exchange of ideas and so on. And I've been doing that ever since that Pearl Harbor conference. That was such an important conference to me personally, that this 1969 conference, Pearl Harbor. We wrote the Pearl Harbor. Here were American scholars and Japanese scholars coming together, jointly examining the record together. To write this still very useful book on how we got to Pearl Harbor throughout the 1930s. I think Chinese and Korean and Japanese historians also could do that kind of thing. I think they have begun to do it. I mean, thanks to Dachin and others who have been promoting it, I think it's the best way. And I'd like to conclude by putting that in some kind of perspective on what I think about the scholarly world, so to speak. And I am very encouraged. I guess I have no choice at my age. You have to be either very encouraged or very discouraged. And I am very, very encouraged, optimistic about the future of scholarly collaboration, what I call scholarly transnationalism in the world. That is, there are so much more exchange among scholars today than there ever was. Certainly among historians, there is a global community. I mean, we are thanks to the internet, but also symposia, books, affairs, other kind of things. We're always in touch with each other, and I think I'm very encouraged with the fact that we are exchanging ideas, and when, as we exchange ideas, expressing our disagreements or agreement or whatever, we are not divided along national lines. We don't say, well, these are too critical of Japan or something. I never say that. If anything, I say this is not critical enough of Japan. But I think Korean scholars, Chinese scholars, I mean, there's a blanket view of Chinese scholars today as being under the control of the government, and they are not free to speak their minds. They are not free to express themselves. That's not quite true. When I go to China and I meet with Chinese scholars, they are very free. They're almost like American scholars. At least in the classroom, anyway, in the environmental, in the educational environment, I go there and talk with Chinese historians or their students. I mean, certainly they are as open-minded as scholars or students of other countries. I think you can do that. And this is what I find very encouraging. And as a historian, if I were to try to historicize it, try to understand the phenomenon, it seems to me that the world has been moving in that direction since the 1970s. I mean, this is maybe controversial, but in my view of history, the Second World War and the Cold War as its byproduct comes to an end around 1970. And from 1970 to the present, it's a different post-Cold War world. It's a more internationalized, more transnational world. What I mean by that is that here, geopolitical issues are losing their significance. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate it, but geopolitical questions like the territorial disputes in China, Japan, they're still there. But we should not be totally concerned, preoccupied with those territorial disputes, but that we should emphasize interconnectedness, the connections are what make today's world. Emily Rosenberg at the U.S. Irvine, she edited a book 2 years ago called The World Connected. Is that the title? The World Connected. That is a history of the world between 1870 and 1945, in saying that the world was becoming interconnected through technology, of course, the telegraph and telegram, newspapers and so on, but also thanks to all kinds of organizations, non-state organizations. The world has become more and more connected after 1870, and even though we have had disruptions, wars and things, but we should not be predominated. When I think about the recent past, the past century or something like that, we tend to focus on wars and Cold War. We should not do that. I think we should emphasize instead the interconnectedness, interconnections across national boundaries, because the world has become much more interconnected through population movements, through immigration, but also through shared concerns about the environment, about human rights, and in fact, the idea of human rights seems to be the key today. I would rather talk about human rights, I would rather study the history of human rights rather than the history of national rights. I mean, national rights, you talk about Chinese sovereignty, Korean territorial integrity, these are very, very important, of course, but equally important would be human rights of Chinese, human rights of Koreans, and Japanese, and so on. Abe did indicate, talk about human rights, and I was struck by the fact that he talks about the rights of women. He's talking about the comfort woman, and she says, he says that women's human rights. He says Japan will lead the world. I don't know, it seems to be a bit of an exaggeration, but he says Japan will lead the world in making the 21st century an era in which women's human rights are not infringed upon. Well, he's learning something here, I think, that there is such a thing as human rights, and that comfort women, women's rights have been violated in the past. So if Japan is going to stand up for human rights, first thing Japan has to do is to be concerned with the rights of women. And that, I think that's very, very important. And this does not simply mean comfort of women, but it means the rights of Japanese women, housewives, and ordinary employees who still seem to be discriminated against. The status of vis-a-vis men still seems to leave a great deal to be desired. But I agree with Abe in the sense that human rights is going to be increasingly important, and that we should pay more attention to it. And from that perspective, I go back, and I think that we can say that from about 1970, national rights as such begin to become less important than human rights. We are much more concerned with what happens in Africa, Caribbean, and so on. Human rights of other people, migrants, and those who suffer from earthquakes and environmental disasters. I think we're today concerned with human rights rather than more than with national rights. And I think it's very right for historians everywhere to do that, because historians have established a global community. That's one of the things I'm very much encouraged about in my lifetime, to exaggerate. There did not used to be such a thing as a global network of historians. And today there is not just one global network of historians, several networks of historians. So we are in communication with each other, we can be talking to each other. Those kinds of networks, irrespective of nationality, would be the way of the future. And then I must say I'm very encouraged by that. So to end in a somewhat optimistic note, and Dr. Jim was very kind to say that I have been working in the United States since the 1960s, and from 1961 when I got my degree to today, the past 50 some years, nothing encourages me more, nothing pleases me more than the fact that than the recognition of human rights, the importance of human rights. Human rights history, historians are belatedly beginning to write published books on human rights. Barbara Keyes, I think it's very, very good. I mean, someone like Barbara Keyes, teaching, she's from Oregon, I think, came to Harvard, got a degree, and then teaching in Melbourne, very transnational kind of scholarship, and writes this wonderful book on human rights in history. And others have been writing on human rights. And I think that's a trend among historians. I think you're going to see fewer and fewer histories of just one nation. Even Chinese history, Korean history, Japanese history. I think history writing in the future is going to be much more human history, because to exaggerate, but I've been saying this to many people, there's only one history, that's human history. There's no national history. I mean, national history really has existed about two centuries in the West, maybe less than a century in many countries in the world. I mean, nations really are not as important as humanity. And that's why I think we should talk more about that, and we should focus more on human issues, human phenomena. And to that extent, I must say that I'm very encouraged by the trend. There's an emphasis on transnational connections, on connections and human behavior. And as a result of interactions, coming together, there are people, historians nowadays use terms such as blending, hybridity. I think hybridity is a wonderful concept, because there's no such thing as purity anywhere, right? And there's no such thing as a pure nation anywhere. The Japanese, you say Japan is a pure country, so that's absolute nonsense. Japan is a very hybrid country, has been for centuries. every country basically is a hybrid country, so we should not talk about national character. I mean, there is no such thing as national character. What we have is hybridity of all countries. And when you go to that direction, all countries are interdependent, they're interchangeable, they're hybrid, they're blending with each other all the time, making for human community. And so my reflections on 70th anniversary is that such a wonderful thing that a world which had been divided into nations and fighting against each other, killing millions of people, now to the extent that they are now aware of human rights. I mean, isn't it a wonderful thing? We are aware of saving just one human life, it's worth all the effort, right? Instead of preparing for killing 20 million enemy people, I think we should be worried. I mean, we seem to be worrying more and more about impact on the environment, and disease, things like that. And somebody who is, as I said, of the senior generation, so aging people, I even think of the rights of people, aging people. Many of them are beginning to lose their memory, beginning to lose their momentum, mobility. And that's a great thing. I think the past several decades, many countries, including, of course, the United States, are paying more and more attention to that, and I can only welcome that. So that's sort of a swan song of an aging person. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Yuri. One of the hallmarks of Professor Yuri's scholarship is in studying international relations, we should not only focus on power, but also culture, by which he meant ideas, values, and especially the transnational ideas and values. And as you can see in his speech, he's still very much dedicated to promoting this idea of the transnational values, such as human rights, should be the subject of study. I think this is very good advice for people inside the Beltway who make decisions about world affairs, and we tend to be very obsessed about sort of hard power aspect. He has kindly agreed to take a few questions. I think we have 5 minutes or so, if anyone would like to raise a question. Please wait for the mic and speak aloud.
Thank you very much, Professor Inie. My name is Vanessa Ward from the University of Otago in Dunedin, New Zealand. Should I infer from your... Should I infer from your comments and your dating of 1970 that transnationalist projects before that were somehow compromised by Cold War policy? I'm particularly interested in things like IHOUSE, International House in Tokyo, and the US-Japan Committee for Intellectual Interchange. Thank you.
That's a very fascinating question of chronology. I think historians just love to try to chronologize the past. And is 1970 or 1970s such an important decade? I tend to think so. Some of you may not. I remember going to Paris. My wife and I spent a few weeks in Paris this summer. And going to the bookstore, I noticed one book, a recent book published, called The Second World War, French, but Second World War, 1937 to 1947. So from the French perspective, the Second World War may have begun in 1937, ended in 1947. Why 47? Must have been because from this historian's perspective, the war did not really end in 1945. Germany surrendered because of all the Eastern European complications and so on. And the Cold War as such does not come to define international affairs until 1947. If you take that view, then the Second World War was a 10-year war, 37 to 47. You may not agree with that. Americans may have a different understanding of the past. And Chinese, as I said, and Japanese, many Japanese had a view that the Second World War was a 15-year war. and 31 to 45, things like that. So my perspective on it is that nations as such, the nations emerge all over the world, in the West, of course, in the 18th century, but from about 1870, I think, you have a number of independent nations and they begin to fortify themselves and begin to prepare for war, they go to war against each other. That kind of nation-centric, power-oriented phase of history lasts from about 1870 to 1970, and it seems to me that from about 1970, with the easing of Cold War tensions, and the rise of new issues like the environment, human rights, as I said, and there's exchange programs and things like that, things do begin to change. And your question is whether these exchange programs may not have existed before 1970, but quite clearly, yes. I mean, a very good friend of mine is writing a history of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Carnegie Endowment was established in 1924, something like that, and Rockefeller Foundation precedes that. The Ford Foundation is established in its current form in 1936, wasn't it? Foundations in the United States promoting international exchange, cultural exchange, going back many decades before 1970. Now, I say 1970 because it seems to me that from about that time, these issues that divide nations, like territorial disputes and trade disputes, become less and less important in comparison with the growth of more transnational issues of migrations, the environment, human rights, that is, issues that affect all countries, and therefore issues that have to be solved by all nations, or by the world community, seem to grow in importance from the 1970s onwards. That's why you can no longer write the history of the world as if nations were the only important units. I mean, for example, men and women, if you write women's gender history, women's history, it's really, it makes no sense to have one chapter about American women, another chapter on Chinese women, and so on. I think women have a global presence. The same is true with men, and as I said, coming back to all the people, I mean, whenever I go abroad, whether it's China, or Europe, Japan, you know, I sense that there's something people of 1930s share in common, not only because of the experience in the 1930s, but also because they're all concerned about their age. And that's a fact. And for younger people, they may be very interested in child growth. I mean, if they have young children at home, the problems that children face are really interchangeable. You cannot talk about American babies and Chinese babies, are they all babies, right? Same is true with many other things, and that seemed to me that from the 1970s onwards, these kinds of more transnational issues grow in importance, and historians, I think, just rather belatedly began to pay attention to that. That's why you may be struck by the fact that more and more historians are writing about 1970s. I mean, it's quite a recent past, but nevertheless, 1970s do appear to have been very, very significant in that sense. And if you talk about 1970s and 80s, still in the framework of national affairs, I think you're way behind the reality. The reality is that national frameworks are becoming much less significant than global issues, transnational questions.
Sorry, we only have one time.
One
question. So,
Thank
you very much, and we have to move to the next panel. We're not going to take a coffee break, but we'll just need a few minutes to set up for the next panel, because one of the two speakers is Skyping in.